When we talk about green jobs, what do you mean?
Green jobs are the jobs that help, that are created in, if we're moving towards an economy system of production industries that are have less of an environmental footprint, that reduce their environmental impact over time so that they ultimately become environmentally sustainable. That assumes the creation of new jobs, different types of jobs, which will help to reduce the emissions that we have, that help to reduce the amounts of raw material that we need. They help to reduce the pollution and the emissions that come with production and consumption of things.
Give me some specific examples.
Examples are perhaps the poster child of a green job is a job in the renewable energy sector, where we produce electricity with wind power or with solar power, or where we you produce your hot water requirements or your steam with solar thermal devices. So you use a renewable source of energy that produces very, very little pollution, and that has a very, very small environmental impact.
Okay, but that sounds a little bit like a bit of a green niche. Are we talking about a niche, or are we talking about a wider trend?
You have those jobs that are directly linked to the greening of the economy, like those in the renewable sector, but you also have them in energy efficiency, which is a huge area. We know that it's not only about producing cleaner energy, but of using much less, of reducing our needs for additional energy. And that goes through all walks of life, but the biggest in terms of employment is perhaps the building sector. Buildings are consume something like 40% of all energy in the world. And that requirement could be reduced to well under half without losing any quality of life, on the contrary. But that assumes that you can renovate much of the existing building stock. Buildings exist for a long time. A building stays there for 80, 100 years. And many of the buildings that we have today were built in a time when energy was ridiculously cheap. And so they're extremely wasteful. To renovate these buildings make economic sense. You can recover the investment from the savings in your electricity bill or your fuel bill in the future as you continue to use the building. And it is local, very specific work that requires local artisans. It's very labor intensive. So you have an enormous direct employment effect. And those, you could call them green jobs, because they help to make the building sector more durable, more environmentally friendly.
So is what you're saying that the kind of buildings that we have become used to seeing in Hong Kong and Singapore, these shards of glass, hundreds of feet high, these will need to be rethought?
Many of those are unfortunately still built to specifications that are not terribly terribly efficient. And so that is one of our concerns that we have jointly with UNEP, that we need to change, we need to make sure that future buildings are much better than the ones that we have. But that assumes that there is much more awareness in the construction industry, that you have people with the skills who actually know how to build a very energy efficient building, how to design one and then how to build it. Skills development in this area is going to be an enormous challenge, and we already have skills shortages in all the areas linked to green jobs, from the renewable industry to the to transport sector, to the building sector, to waste management, to life cycle analysis. There's obviously it is something that people hadn't seen coming, as the implications that the greening of an economy will have for the labor market haven't been anticipated, and I think we're all suffering from the consequences.
The implications of what you say about buildings alone are really very significant. I mean, they imply retraining not only for blue-collar workers who build the buildings, right up to architects who design them. Now, if you take an economy like Singapore or indeed like Hong Kong, it has been said that those economies blossomed purely and simply because of the advent of air conditioning. Is what we're saying about green jobs that this cannot continue?
No, I don't think so. But the needs for air conditioning, of course, skyrocket if you have purely if you have very poorly insulated buildings, and if you don't use shades, you don't use heat exchangers. When you bring in new air, that new air is going to be fresh air from the outside. That air is going to be fairly hot, and if you don't cool that down with using the stale air that is inside the building before it leaves, then you need enormous amounts of energy. If you don't have passages that ensure that you're not every time a door opens, you get a wave of hot air into a very cool building. In many places in the Northern Hemisphere, we have the opposite with excessive heating, and every time somebody opens the door, you have all that cold air coming in. And so all these from a design perspective, but also from the way that the hull of a building is constructed, and the whole air conditioning or heating system or lighting system is conceived and is operating, all these will change. And that does not imply a loss of quality of life. On the contrary, you can do much more with a lot less.
We've talked a little about people who will have to change, and that there will be some winners. Some of the industries will expand as a result of the green jobs movement. There will, of course, be losers. Who will lose?
It looks like those who will lose are the ones who are have very, very high levels of energy consumption. Sectors like glass, cement, aluminum, many other metals, pulp and paper have very high levels of energy consumption, and those may be very difficult to sustain in a world where energy prices continue to go up and there is going to be a penalty on emissions in the future, where there's going to be a price on the greenhouse gases that we emit, and particularly on carbon dioxide. So those sectors are likely to lose. For other sectors, it will maybe depend very much on how they manage to adapt. Take the car industry. Currently, the car industry is a problem. They are a large and growing source of emissions because we use petrol, we use fossil fuels in very inefficient engines. If we manage to move to cars that are powered by electricity, and if that electricity comes from a clean source, say from solar electricity generation, then the car industry has taken a quantum leap, and it has turned from a problem into part of the solution. But you have other transport solutions anyway that may make more sense, because cars also have the problem of congestion and you have the problem of accidents, and those wouldn't go away with electrical cars. In Beijing, for example, they discovered that they badly needed to expand the subway system, because otherwise you just couldn't cope with all the surface traffic anymore. So within sectors like, say, between individual transport based on cars and mass mobility based on rail, light rail or trains, or you're likely to see shifts. The same will happen perhaps with the aviation industry. If the aviation has been growing very rapidly, but you see it more and more over relatively short distances, where you wonder whether that really makes sense and whether not, say, high-speed trains would be a very good alternative to burning kerosene in airplanes to just go 500-kilometer hops.
So the message for the developing economies would be that you should not look to adopt the consumption habits of the developed, such as a private car for every family. But at a government level, you should be looking for different solutions to the problem.
There's some leapfrogging that is possible. It is probably clever not to make some of the mistakes that were made in building very, very inefficient cities and allowing them to acquire a structure that now obliges you to have this transport system where people spend hours on end in commuting, something that everybody hates, in fact. It's an enormous waste and loss of everything. So if, to the extent that you can where you're in a phase of rapid urbanization and you can't put these systems in place, you can avoid the suburbs and the need to commute over dozens of kilometers every day back and forth, you know, with in individual cars sitting in traffic jams.
I mean, this sounds great. It sounds very logical. But who's going to pay for these changes? How are they going to be funded?
We have rising energy prices and we have rising commodity prices. So efficiency of more efficient use of energy and a more efficient use of raw materials starts to make ever more economic sense. Increasingly, there is going to be a direct penalty on pollution, where that pollution takes the form of heavy metals and effluents in water and pollution of air. The people who are at the receiving end of that, they already know it. And it's an enormous price and it's a hidden cost on the current type of development that we have. In the future, those trends are going to continue. Energy is going to be even more expensive and so will be raw materials. Water is going to be scarce in many places, in particular in Asia. And that means that people will be more economical. On the other hand, we will see in international agreements now a price being put on carbon. So emissions are going to be ever more costly. And it means that you have a strong incentive to avoid that. And you can adopt a clean development, a green growth strategy that avoids that totally unnecessary cost and that probably on balance is much more effective in improving the quality of life of people, including their working life.
The backbone of the economies in Asia are small and medium-sized enterprises, not large companies. Now, many of these may say, green jobs, very nice, but we can't afford it. Do you think a helping hand will have to be given to these enterprises?
There is clearly a challenge with awareness amongst these entrepreneurs. A lot of them have their nose on the grindstone. They're busy doing what they have to do every day, running their enterprises, getting their contracts, getting them delivered, making sure that their workers are doing what they're expected. But they don't have that still on their screen. They don't see that it's something that is coming and that will have an impact on them. And we are concerned that many of the regulations that are now being put in place and many of the financial mechanisms, even of the incentives that are trying to help enterprises to adopt better practices, to adopt better technologies, will bypass that sector and that they will reduce thereby inadvertently this enormous pool of employment that they represent, and that would be very negative. So we think it's important to work on the awareness amongst these entrepreneurs and to work on their preparedness, develop their skills, build it into management programs, but also build it into the training programs for their workers.
Yeah. And what role do you think the ILO can and should play in this?
The ILO has this advantage that it sees the connection between the environment and the world of work. We have the employers, the industry, if you will, and the workers of countries directly as members, and they are confronted with those problems, which is very different from the purely environmental fora that make those policies. The climate change convention and this new international agreement is hammered out by people who have a purely environmental perspective. And it is, for us, it's absolutely essential to point out to them that what they're doing is changing an economy. It's not changing an energy supply system or, you know, reducing air pollution, for example.